Having a story well told, and Truly has done an excellent job of sharing her work with people all over the United States. She does a great job with social networking, huge Facebook presence. I don't know if y'all are Facebook friends with Shirley, but she's great on Facebook, so you should go home and friend her. That's actually how I met Shirley, I think, is through Facebook. And I feel like she's become a mentor to me as a fellow English teacher. Shirley taught English at Goshen, and I teach English at George Fox. She's mentored me in that way through social networking. She's mentored me as a writer through social networking, and I know I'm not the only person with whom she has that relationship. So I feel like I met an old friend today when I got to pick up Shirley in Portland, even though we'd never met before. And I know that in sharing her story, you'll feel like she's a friend to you too. Shirley was a president at Goshen College,
1996. I was named in 96, took the office in 97, and was there until 2004.
Okay, and previous to that, she was an English teacher at Goshen. She worked for a while at the Fetzer Institute, and she and her husband Stuart are traveling by train up the West Coast, making stops along the way. It sounds really romantic and fun. Not romantic in that sense, it's just like fun. I know that Amtrak isn't always as wonderful an experience as it can be, but I think they've had a great time so far and will continue to have a great time traveling up the West Coast, and then you're traveling through Canada, is that right?
From Vancouver, we're coming back to Seattle and then taking the Empire Builder back to West Virginia.
So that'll be a long, nice long trip. All right, so Shirley's gonna share with us from her book. She has a few copies of her book to sell and to sign, and then we're gonna have a reception outside afterwards when it's a little bit cooler.
The plant is right between us.
She's gonna be standing up.
Maybe, since the plant's purpose
is
we could move the plant and I could hold this.
All right, that's fine with me. That works better.
Hi. Thank you, Melanie. I am so delighted to see you here tonight and to be here to experience the Pacific Northwest and to connect with old friends and make new friends. That's been, Melanie was absolutely right. It is romantic to take a trip like this. Stuart and I will be married for 45 years on August 2. So we thought we'd celebrate for the whole month beforehand. And being here with you is part of our celebration. And so I'm very, very pleased to see your faces. I know that I know many of you and hope to talk to all of you who wish to individually. Tonight, since we are in a place that was built to honor the heritage and tradition of Mennonites, I'd like to speak about my own heritage and tradition as a Mennonite. I'm going to say a little bit about how I came to write a memoir, and then I'll read a little bit. And then, for me, the fun part is when we get to do interactive conversation. So we'll have some questions and answers. And I have photos that came from the book. And I'm apologizing that I don't have a lot of books here. So if there are more people who want books than there are books, I can sign these. And we can arrange for you to get a book at a later time through the Historical Society. So. I wasn't expecting so many of you, and I wasn't expecting to sell so many books this morning, so you never know what will come about the trip, especially when you carry your books with you in your suitcase, and we're very happy if we end up having a lighter load, and we hope that everybody who wants a book can get one way or another. I would like to know a little bit more about you. And I want to know how many of you have written memoirs. I knew there were some. Okay, one, two, three, four. How many of you would like to write a memoir? Okay. That's a few more. How many of you hope you never write a memoir? That seems to carry the majority, but there's an interest out there too. And maybe some of you who never want to write one might have some interest in how one gets written. So I will share a little bit of that journey with you, and also try to offer a few words of encouragement to those of you who are in the process now. We'd love also to hear some words of testimony from those of you who have written a memoir as to what it means to you. So I'll start by saying a little bit of what it means to me to have written Lush. I want my grandchildren to know what it was like to grow up Mennonite, to grow up in a farm, to grow up in the 1950s and 1960s, and to take that kind of root structure that was produced in that environment and take it into the rest of the world, and to do so while remaining Mennonite, because that is my particular story. And there have been a lot of stories about people who maybe grew up in a conservative religious tradition and left that tradition. Those memoirs are usually the first to be told. And they sometimes are told with bitterness, sometimes they're told with humor, sometimes they're told with distance, and other times with intimacy or even nostalgia and longing. So there are many, many ways to tell your story. But to tell a story about how one life changed at the same time the church that produced the life is changing, that became my challenge. Because, as most of you know, the Mennonite Church has changed a lot, wherever you grew up in it, since the 1950s and 60s. And so, I wanted to tell a story that would be for children and for grandchildren, but to also then keep building on larger and larger possible audiences. Other Mennonites first, and then people I knew had an interest in Mennonites. I hope to reach those people too, and have had some wonderful conversations with people all over the country who've read this book, some of whom are people in different religions or no religion. Some are very interested in Amish and Mennonite things, and others just learned about the book in other ways. So it's gratifying to know that those people can also read and find something for themselves in the story. So how did the book come about? I'm an English teacher. I read a lot of stories. I chose English because I love stories. And I taught a course called Expository Writing many years. There might even be one or two people in this room who took that course or took another one. From me or from Stuart, who also taught writing. But in the expository writing class, we had one assignment called the personal essay that every time I gave the assignment to the students to read a personal essay from the collection of stories and essays that we had as our text, and then to write one themselves, they enjoyed the personal essay, and they enjoyed writing a personal essay more than any other of the assignments, and certainly much more than the research paper, which was the end result of that class. They didn't like writing it, I didn't like grading it. It was something we needed to do. But when it came to the personal essay, there was a lot more energy. And I noticed that. I also noticed that when I read somebody else's personal essay, personal stories of my own cropped up. And if I read E.B. White talking about going to the lake, Once More to the Lake was the title of his story, I remembered all the summers that we had spent in the lake at Michigan. And so that whole process of communicating stories, person to person, and from the written word to the person, ended up stimulating my interest in writing personal essays. And I began to write some in the 80s and 90s. I used a personal style when I was writing my presidential speeches and communicating with alumni. Enjoyed that, got a lot of personal response back from people who had read the back page of the Goshen College Bulletin and things like that. But it was one particular assignment, or not assignment, but opportunity that led me to write the book that you see before you today. And that was a contest in the Kalamazoo Gazette, which is where we were living in Kalamazoo, and there was a literary award contest. And the categories were fiction, poetry, and memoir. And the requirement was that it couldn't be longer than 2,000 words. So that seemed like a very reasonable thing, and I thought this would be a great time to go on retreat, which I did, for 2 days and 2 nights and 3 days. I didn't speak to anybody else. I did a lot of walking in nature, and I just remembered. I had some artifacts from my past, some pictures, some of the things in the scrapbook my mother kept for me, and I began to write, and it just flowed. And the story that I wrote first is the story that I'm going to read to you tonight. It's not in exactly the same form as I wrote it for the newspaper contest, but it is close to the same form that is in the book, and has changed somewhat over time, as stories often do. That story was a way of stimulating a theme that then went on later on to become the theme of the book, which was this: the child's experience as a child, but growing up and encountering difference. But encountering it for really the first time in the most dramatic way when I was 5, 6 years old. So I'm going to read you the story, and from there on, say just a few more words about the process from there on. I should say that the main character of the story is a young girl who was nicknamed Rosy Cheeks, and whose cheeks still get a little rosy when she speaks or gets excited about things. And Rosy Cheeks, I like to think of as a character, as though I'm writing fiction. And Rosy Cheeks always went for the prize. You know, if there was a contest, Rosy Cheeks was there. She liked softball. She wanted to hit it over the creek. She liked to get engaged in her school activities, and if there were ribbons or prizes, she went for them. Doesn't mean she always won them. But Rosy Cheeks got the first prize for this story. And that there was still enough of Rosy Cheeks in me that really, that little piece of an external encouragement meant a lot to me. And from then on, I wrote more personal essays for the Kalamazoo Gazette for the next 3 years. And by the end of the 3 years, after having won prizes every year and after enjoying it every time, I thought, oh, maybe I should write a book. So that's what the little seed was there from this beginning. In 1954, something amazing happened. A little girl, my own age, from a faraway place called New York City, came to live with us for 2 whole weeks. I had absolutely no concept of the city. My world was 80 acres of farmland and a church in the middle of a small town called Lititz. I was excited to meet our fresh air girl, Vicky Martinez. Mother and Daddy said we could pick her up at the Lancaster train station. She was almost 6 years old, and like me, she would be entering first grade in the fall. Waiting for our fresh air girl to arrive in that huge, unfamiliar station, train station, interestingly enough, reminded me of exchanging Christmas presents. If you pick the wrong package, you might get a crocheted hanky. And someone next to you would get six kinds of lifesavers displayed under cellophane in their own fancy package. You either pick a winner or a loser. My fear that we would get a loser disappeared the minute I saw Vicky. Her big dark eyes and abundant curly hair, her olive skin and her pretty dress spelled fun to me. As we left the station, my mind was whirling with plans. We would give Vicky so much good, fresh country excitement that she would be filled with fresh air all year long. As the oldest child in our family, I was used to being in charge of things. I expected to guide our guest, Vicky, too. She listened as I gave her a tour of the farm and showed her the room we would share. She seemed to be impressed by green grass, trees, flowers, and vegetable gardens, dogs and cats, wide, long fields of alternating green and brown, and especially cows. Just presenting our everyday life and familiar animals to Vicky made them seem suddenly exotic. We loved watching her eyes get wider as she got close to a big black and white Holstein. She wondered how milk came out of a cow. So my father knelt down, pulled on a teat, and sent a stream of milk that pooled right at Vicky's feet. "Holy cow," she exclaimed, much to our delight. After a few hours of hitting the highlights of country living, we went back to the bedroom that we would be sharing. When Vicky opened her suitcase, I smelled something pungent, sweet, and spicy. I locked that new aroma into my brain under the label New York City. Vicky's shorts and shirts and skirts came in a rainbow of colors. Her mother had very carefully placed enough little folded outfits, clean underwear, and socks for each day of her journey in the country. I could tell just by looking at that suitcase that Vicky's mother loved her. Back down in the kitchen, Vicky asked, "Where's your TV?" Mother explained to her that we were Mennonites and our church did not allow television because it was worldly. Mother herself wore a modest maternity smock, a sign that she was expecting. Her hair was pulled back into a severe bun, and she wore a white prayer covering on her head. I could see from Vicky's expression that she was beginning to wonder if she had pulled the wrong Christmas present out of the gift exchange. It had not occurred to me that our family might be judged as a set of losers by our own fresh air girl. Soon, however, Vicky was chattering again. She told us about her parents, her mother, Josephine, who was raising eight children, and her father, Joseph, a cook who worked in a hospital. She told us her full name was Carmen Victoria Martinez. Lovely, strange sounds that rolled around in her mouth. When I tried repeating them, the accent never seemed to fall on the right syllables. She lived at 178 Avenue D, apartment 11B, New York, New York. I learned to chant her address. It was so much more fun to say than our own. Rural Route 1, Mannheim, Pennsylvania. Through Vicky, I began to imagine what it might be like to live in the city. She told us how she convinced the police officer to turn on a fire hydrant to make a fountain. She told about buying Italian ices from a man with a little cart on the streets. Vicky's most lasting contribution to my vocabulary was a form of city pig Latin called gibberish. My name, Shirley, for example, became, in gibberish, Shirla Girlidigi. Vicky was Vitikikidigi. My brother Henry and I loved our first foreign language, but we never got to be as proficient as Vicky. Sunday presented a challenge for us. because Vicki was not sure she should go to our church. And no one considered taking her to the Catholic Church, which happened to be just right across the street from Lititz Mennonite. Catholics, Vicki told us, were forbidden to attend Protestant services. So she devoutly pinned a Kleenex on her head and stuffed her ears with cotton balls. True. Bringing a Catholic to our church caused a little thrill on the women's side of the sex-segregated pews where we sat. Our service always included a time for the children to come forward. One of the adults would tell a story using a large piece of cardboard covered with flannel. Even through her cotton-stuffed ears, Vicki seemed to enjoy the stories. Everyone was especially kind to her, and I imagine there were some silent prayers for the salvation of the little girl from the city. When it was finally time to take Vicki back to the train station, my mother hugged her and handed her a letter to take home to her mother, Josephine. We waved goodbye, promising to see each other again next year. As Vicki packed up her little suitcase almost as neatly as her mother had done, I again caught a whiff of the spicy city aroma inside that brown case. Good a good buddy guy, little good of you, I said. Good a good buddy guy, short a girl, little bee, she said twice as fast, flashing me a smile as bright as Lady Liberty's torch. For decades, during my busy mothering and professional years, I seldom thought of Vicki. But on a recent Christmas visit to my family in Pennsylvania, I came across a stash of yellowed envelopes in Mother's basement. I noticed a familiar return address on one of them, 178 Avenue D, apartment 11B, New York, New York. This must be Josephine Martinez's handwriting, I thought. I looked at the gracious flow, a woman who had carefully pressed 14 outfits and placed them gently into a suitcase, would have just this kind of penmanship. But while living in New York City myself in 2012, I thought about Vicki a lot. Finally, I took the subway to the Lower East Side and retraced the steps to Avenue D that Vicki took in 1954. Block after block of brown, red, and orange brick apartments surrounded the streets. I kept walking. Finally, at the end of the street, there it was, 178 Avenue D. I stood at the corner and looked up at apartment 11B and remembered the phone call I had gotten from my mother in 1985. Vicki died, mother said tenderly. Multiple sclerosis. There, on the street, 27 years after the phone call, I grieved again for Vicki. I remembered the two of us as five-year-olds, together opening up for each other larger worlds inside small ones. Those little girl spirits, passionate and liberating, blew through me like a saving breath of fresh air. It's really fun to read that story. By the way, I should have explained the fresh air program. Do you know it? Everybody knows it? Okay. Good. You actually have it here too? Okay. I had the pleasure of reading the same portion from the book in New York City about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And usually when I've read it before, I've read it to audiences who identify with the little Mennonite girl. And in that audience, it was so fun. The jokes that were in here that were for the country people weren't as funny to them. But the ones that were there for the city people, they really enjoyed. So it was a wonderful experience to connect, and to Vicky's sister, who came, who lives in New York, and who came to the event so that she could be there. And one of the other schoolmates of Vicky was there as well. So I think I have some pictures here of her that I can send around. This one in particular is, Vicky was a lot like me. We had some similar personality traits. And even though she had multiple sclerosis, she was the poster girl for multiple sclerosis. And she got to meet Mickey Mantle. So here's a picture of Vicky, the oldest picture that I have of her, after she no longer came to our house in the summertime. And here's another picture of my brother Henry and I with Vicky after we had just gone through the sprinklers, the big exciting thing we did. You know, we didn't have pools, we didn't go to the beach, we ran through the sprinklers.
Did she come more than one time?
She did. She came from age 6 to age 12, which I think was the end of the program. And so I really did get to know her well. And our mothers corresponded. I feel bad that I never, in that whole period when she was experiencing multiple sclerosis and was, I'm sure, lonely. My mother was the person who related to her, not me. We didn't have the teenage years and beyond together. And so even though I cared about her, my life was this way and her life was this way. And only as an adult have I come to see how really significant she was in helping me understand the wider world, helping me to, you know, even when you have to explain things like how your farm works and how your, what you believe in, you are automatically engaged in a process of education and self-knowledge and enlarging your ability to love from where you started out. And so I am grateful to Vicky for many, many things, including the inspiration to write my own book. I wish I could be sharing it with her here, but it was great that I could be with her sister. We have already gone 30 minutes, and I would simply like to open the floor to you for questions to find out what you care to know about. Some of you, I see, have books of your own that you've brought here tonight. You might want to ask any questions about having read the story. Others of you, not having read the story, might want to know other things, and I'm very open. So. Yes.
You see, on your 16th birthday, you got a black convertible, I think, from your parents.
It wasn't quite the 16th birthday, but just a little afterwards.
Well,
yes.
My question, growing up in Lancaster, conference with Lancaster and Bennett High School, not that far away from where you lived, was that ever a serious family discussion about where you should go to school?
It was not a very serious discussion. The issues were that Lancaster Mennonite High School, for those of you who are not familiar with the area, is on Route 30, and Libbetts is north of Lancaster. Route 30 is very close to the Lancaster City outskirts, and Libbetts is 7 miles north on 501, which would have meant that I would have had about a 15-mile journey on not only on the highway going to Route 30, but on a very, very busy highway that seemed like it was just a little bit too far and too dangerous for travel. I love my Warwick High School, and if I had gone to Lancaster Mennonite school, I would have become a much more plain Mennonite than I actually was. And I was reminded this morning by somebody who grew up on Amish that you were not very plain. and she's right. Because that's part of the story. I actually had competing definitions of what it meant to be Mennonite from my two grandparents. These are my Hershey grandparents. You can see this is their wedding picture. They're quite soberly attired and were from their youth. This is a picture of my Hess grandparents, who were much more fun-loving and much more worldly, and who were another model for how to be Mennonite, even in Lancaster County. They were the old model. The model of it's not so much based on revivalism as it is based on how you kind of gradually grow into the church over time and with the help of the community. And that meant that you had your Mennonite form of Rumspringa, and there was a lot of fancy clothes and cars and things like that in youth, and all the way for them, past marriage, to the first child. When my grandmother then became a member of the church, and so did my grandfather, and from then on, she dressed like this. So she looked very, very plain, but underneath she had had all these experiences. And when my mother graduated from high school, she looked like this. And she was going to Landis Valley Mennonite Church the whole time. And so my mother's influence in my life, many, many ways, including her love of things that were sometimes forbidden by the church, like the theater and drama and violin playing and even novel reading and doing those things rather than gardening and rather than doing the good wife things that were extolled among most of her friends. So I had no desire to be any plainer than I was required to be by the bishop and the minister of my own church. And Lancaster Mennonite School at that time required you, they were kind of working out a consensus among all the groups that supported them and went with the more conservative rules so that they could get conservative students there and hope that they would have enough students who came from more liberal churches that they would still be able to reach across and have a student body of a significant size, which they did. But I was not interested in going, and my parents had no desire to ask me to go. Furthermore, it cost money, and those were the issues. It was conservative, it cost money, and getting there was a challenge. And so instead, my father bought me a convertible, which
what a great guy.
When I look back on it now, it's just wild that he did that. But and it was wild that I was wearing a covering on my head, and I had to, you know, the regular old straight pins did not tack it down adequately. So I had to wear a scarf around my covering on my head while I drove the convertible. Now, life is filled with lots of paradoxes and ironies, and those were just some of the few in my own story. Yes?
What would you say were some of the main differences between how you raised your children and how you were raised?
Very good question. our children grew up in Goshen, Indiana. And I thought about it a lot as they were growing up. I actually sometimes jokingly referred to the campus as the Back 40, thinking of my desire that my children should feel about being part of Goshen College the same way I felt of being part of the farm. And that they would feel free to roam, they would have space, it would be green space, they would have other people looking out for them, which they did. And they would feel a sense of community, as I felt. So I was always looking for the kind of moral equivalent of the farm, because it is a good place to raise children. And the campus was one answer to that, and they enjoyed it. They fully explored most of its nooks and crannies. They grew up in College Mennonite Church. And they grew up at a time when, is it Catherine Royer?
Ashelman
and the Royer sisters, there were two of them, who were in, I don't know if you remember the materials from Herald Press that were produced at Goshen, I think, by the early childhood development people. And the faculty members at the college and the church and the publications were working together to produce materials for children all over the church. In fact, one of the most interesting Facebook conversations of recent memory is when I asked people what they remembered for their Bible school songs. And then I took pictures of my children's books from Sunday school and Bible school, and people's memories of these songs came pouring out. I had many more responses than I anticipated. And so we were situated in a place where not only were my children able to benefit from materials that were produced for children all over the church, but they were able to know the people who were producing these materials, and they were very fine people. People whose lives were dedicated to young children, mostly single women. They loved going to Sunday school. They loved having that kind of, it was a large church, maybe, 1,000 membership, and yet they got to know those teachers very well, and they would, after church was over, they would want to go back to their Sunday school class because the teachers would still be sitting there and they would still be able to either play or talk to them or go to a place that they knew they were loved and cared for and where they were receiving some excellent biblical, really simple biblical lessons. Those were things that I thought of in ways of keeping the connection to the past. When it came to how and when and to relate to the church, I wanted to give them much more choice and freedom in the matter than I felt I had myself. And they chose to continue to come to church, but they did not choose to become baptized. And the church that they have related most to, both of my children have related most to, is the Unitarian Universalist mm-hmm. Church, where they don't have to be baptized.
But they did choose to go to Bethlehem High School.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, there's many, many ways. This is a disappointment of mine. I told them what I hoped for and then gave them freedom. And that's the result. I still hope that someday both of them might become members of the Mennonite Church. It's not impossible. They have no hatred for it. They live in cities and they live contemporary urban life. But they, I do see the values that they were raised with. Very strongly in their lives, and they care a great deal for others and are using their gifts in ways that Stuart and I are grateful to see them and feel that they are indeed spiritual, but they are not Mennonite. And I know that I'm not the only parent who has children in that category, and that many of us would prefer to have our children in the church. I live with the hope and expectation that if they don't become Mennonites, that they will continue growing in faith and in their spiritual life as God directs it in their lives. They are God's children. Mm-hmm. And so how were they taught? I think they were taught values of honesty, frugality, caring for others, things are not as important as people, things like that that came from what we were told. And I see them now raising their children in very similar ways. Yes?
So at the end of your book, you were going to the glittering gold or whatever that was.
Yeah.
That stage where I thought the story would start being really interesting for me. So you got the MC, and like,
yeah.
Did you just like drop the cover when you walked in the door?
Pretty much.
So I was curious what happened with that.
Yeah, well, as you know, like I said, the church was changing. Actually, here is, I don't have a picture of my high school yearbook photo, but there's a story behind that that's not in blush, in that it's the most plain of all my pictures, where you can see the covering most plainly, and the reason it's that way is that my mother asked me to have my picture retaken. Mm-hmm. I had gone to the studio. I did not wear what the other girls wore, which was a drape. Do you remember drapes?
Yeah. And the pearls.
Well, and drapes and pearls. They were the thing that you wore when you had your photo taken for your school pictures, unless you were Mennonite. And so, as a Mennonite, I did not wear that. I had a very high-collar, navy blue suit, top, jacket, and with a white collar. And I had my hair down because I was beginning. The bishop with whom I had had the conflict and with the congregation had had the conflict had already moved on to a more conservative group, which meant that the church began to relax again in the rules that were already beginning. One of the reasons why he was so concerned is he saw that this was, the covering was going, and that was very disconcerting to him. When he left, the gradual decline of the covering continued, the hair got shorter and it came out from under the bun and so forth. So as I got into environments where it was permissible not to wear a covering except to chapel, that's exactly what I did. And I was halfway there by the time I graduated from high school. And at EMU, a lot of people ask whether I will write another book, and I don't know yet whether I will. I'm having too much fun just going around talking about this one, and I don't write any more books. So, and I won't write it unless I feel called to write it. And this one I felt called to write, so I'm waiting to hear what the next signal is on this. But if I did, I would go next in to my college years, which not only interests me from, because I have a lot of memorabilia, even more from those years than I have from my childhood, but they interest me because of what was going on in the United States from the years 1966 to 1970. And a lot of the rest of you were in college at the same time. And there's all kinds of things to say about that. And from this particular position of being in a church that's opening up to the rest of the world, and to be the first time, I believe, in Mennonite American history, excuse me, if there's some water in the house, I just Here's some. Thank you. That being in college during a war and having the majority of the youth of the country feeling like we shouldn't be in this war and protesting the war, it was the first time it had ever happened. And so as the church is changing, we actually have a message for the world that the world is apparently willing to hear. And that put Mennonite youth, many of whom were first generation, as I was, in a situation where, oh my goodness, you know, things are, thank you so much, things are really changing, that other people might feel that war is wrong too. And so I think there's a particular perspective in those years that certainly hasn't been told in the culture at large, which and a combination of being still socially quite conservative by the rest of the standards of the 1960s, and yet having a tradition of being against war to offer and engage with other people who were now interested in that message made it very interesting to me to think about. One of the things I know I will do is go back and read the letters I wrote to my mother, my father, and my siblings all during my college years. And I wrote at least two letters a week, sometimes three or four, back home, because I considered myself to be an explorer, and I was on the moon. I was in college, and nobody had ever gone there before. And so I wanted to describe things for their sake, and I also wanted to alleviate their fear. And I'm now going to be interested to see how I worded things, to see how I was trying to reassure them and yet open them up a little bit and let them see I was having a good time, and yet showing them that there was a connection to what I had been taught and where I came from. And just like Stuart's mother said to her, remember who you are and where you came from.
Did your children go to college then also? Your siblings.
My siblings. In the book you meet Henry, who you've already met, and Sue and Doris and Linda, and another sibling who died. The five living, only one completed college, my brother Henry. And I'm not sure he would have completed college had he not had a motorcycle accident. And there's a connection there between my brother's career, his life, and the relationship between my father and my grandfather, which is the primary conflict in the book. And my brother is then the recipient of their relationship. But in his case, because it sends him on a motorcycle and that motorcycle crashes, he ends up a physical therapist. And he is now a successful physical therapist in Lititz, Pennsylvania. And my sister Sue became the child who went to EMC for one semester, I think it was, and who was dating somebody from back home who was a farmer. And the farmer said to her, you can either go to college or you can have me. She chose him. And he's a very nice man, and they have a lovely family, and they are continuing, probably the of all of us, continuing the tradition that they grew up with most clearly. She is both of them are deacons in the Church of the Brethren, and they are very active in their church. Their children are very active in their church, and they continue to farm, and the next generation is now taking over their farm. So they have made farming their way of life, and the traditional Anabaptist community around them is their primary community. And I have a great deal of respect for my sister, her choices, and I love to go there. And our little grandson and granddaughter love to go there too. They were given a choice. Do you want to go to the beach? Do you want to go to the farm? They chose the farm. And the opposite of what I would have chosen. And so that's interesting to me. Night Sister Doris, who was the one who got requests from the University of Chicago that she please apply to them after she took her SATs, is the one who did not go to college at all, married at age 19, and now lives on the farm in the house my mother built after the farm was sold for development. So she and her husband are very happy. They didn't need college in their lives. They're very typical of many Lancaster people to this day who are not as college-going as the rest of the country. They're entrepreneurial, they are farmers, and they seek employment soon after high school, which is what she did. And she's also very involved in a very large evangelical church. So you can see we have quite a, by the way, my brother is, had been involved in the local Presbyterian church. And then my youngest sister, Linda, went to Heston for 1 year. And then she had a boyfriend and decided to get married, and did. Had three children, had two children, has three in her family. Eventually, she was divorced, and she is now remarried, and her husband is Catholic, and she is enjoying going to the Catholic services with him. So I don't know what her religious affiliation will end up being. She has been either Mennonite or Church of the Brethren all along, but that was a story that I would never have predicted for her. So you can, that's the story of the family. Thank you.
Second question. It's kind of a comment. Your style of writing, your memoir, and reviewing all of what, in one way, is a negative side of your church history, contrasted with other authors. I'm just thinking of Rudy Wheaton, for example. Mm-hmm. And she's so extraordinary. Well, you've written a lot of books. But you are so not only respectful, but reverential, I guess what I would say. You just revere your past, and it comes through here. Although there is a lot of constructive criticism and disagreement. But I think Rudy Wheaton, if I'm not mistaken, has gone full circle now. He's really back as a Mennonite, Church Mennonite or whatever. But did you struggle in also the Gulf and where was it, Fresno? You wrote the
Mennonite, the little black dress.
Yes, the Mennonite. Yeah. Jansen.
Did you struggle? I know you did. You referred to it a little. Yeah, with how to walk that fine line. And at the same time, be honest about everything.
That is, you've put your finger on one of the biggest difficulties, and it's not just in this memoir, but in, I think, in all stories. Where, how much, what will the tone be of your relationship to your past? And I wanted that tone to be loving and truthful simultaneously. And I also wanted to have a little play with it, so it could hold it with some lightness, because I don't want it to be so reverential that it gets, pious, which I don't know why that should be such a bad word, but
yeah.
It is. and the so I didn't want the tone to be artificially sweet or artificially it wouldn't be my story if it were told as completely rebellious and rejecting, because that's not been my experience. In fact, I care a great deal about the Mennonite Church, and I have always cared a great deal about the Mennonite Church. which is one of the reasons why I wrote this book in Brooklyn, New York. And we were taking care of our grandson, who at the time was 4 months to 14 months old, and our children were back at work, and I was trying, and I joined a writer's group in Manhattan. We called ourselves the Manhattan Memoir Posse. And most of the members of the group were Jewish. None of them, one might have been Buddhist, I'm not sure, but none of them had an ongoing religious tradition that they were currently engaged with. And it was great because I wanted to write these stories so they would resonate with Mennonites, but I wanted them to also connect with people who had none of my background. And when I talked about how restless I was as a person needing to wear a prayer covering when I didn't really want to, I said to them, "So do you want to know why I'm still Mennonite?" And immediately they said, "Yes." And that's why I put the last two pages of the book, answering the question, why I am, in parentheses, still a Mennonite. And those words were where I found my tone. I wrote them before I finished revising the rest of the story. And in them, I could claim what I have personally experienced to be salvific about being Mennonite, and say it in a way that could connect to the people in my memoir posse. And that was very, very helpful to me, as was coming up with the first paragraph of the introduction. Because to write a memoir is not a very Mennonite thing to do. I was aware of that. And I think if there's been any issue that has, stirred me in my inner life, it's been this one of between pride and humility. And I know there is something special and wonderful about humility. I want to be humble. But so often I'm not. And as a Mennonite, and I know you know this too, I have experienced a lot of false humility. And I wanted to name the aspiration and the appreciation for genuine humility, and to also talk about the fact that God made us with egos. And writing a book is an egoistic thing to do. And how do you reconcile that with the desire to be submitted to God's will? And to genuinely care as much or more for others than for yourself, which is what we were told. What's joy? Jesus first, others second, yourself last. And that is what I struggled with. I've struggled with it all my life, and when I decided to be honest about that, was when I found my writer's voice. And then from there, I could, I first wrote the 2 pages about why I'm still a Mennonite. Then I wrote that first paragraph about when I was little, I wanted to be big. And not just big as in tall, but big as in successful, important. I wanted to make a splash in the world. When I wrote that, my hands were shaking. And I knew that was like the biggest Mennonite confession I could make. And as a writer, you're encouraged to go there, to go to that spot where you know you have some shame, go to that spot where you know you have fear, go to that spot where you know you're making yourself vulnerable to your reader, and then walk with them. And then try to be as honest as you can about what does big then become after your middle. How do I work through this desire, and where does ego recede, and where does it come back to the fore, and how does the grace of God keep pouring over me despite my small self? And so that, I hope, answers your question. Yeah.
And I just admired your mother so much.
Oh. Thank you. My mother's having a blast. She's 87. And the launch of this book was held at Lititz Mennonite Church. Mother was in like the second or third row, along with all the others. She came with people from Landis Homes in a bus. And one of my former students, was the person who did the emceeing and recognized my mother. When my mother was recognized, she stood up and waved. So I got this kind of honestly.
I love it. That's honesty. I love it.
My daughter is an author.
Yes.
Shirley, I might say that you and Stuart were my whole knowledge of Mennonites up until recently, where I've met Melanie and her piece of the Sculpus. So, and I read the book, and I have even more reverence for the Mennonite church than before. But I wanted to ask, have you share how you got the name Shirley?
Oh, yes. Well, that's all related to our previous conversation. I'm named for Shirley Temple.
I remember you wanted to perform.
And there were, in my mother's growing up, she was the only daughter out of her family, and she had 4 brothers. And her mother was an only daughter, and there were only 2 in the family. And so one of the things, you discover things when you write about your life. And I thought about that for the first time when I started writing. My goodness, in the age when everybody was having 10 children and 8 children and lots of children, and almost inevitably lots of them being girls, here was a grandmother, a Mennonite grandmother, who was an only daughter, and she had an only daughter, and when, as long as I, you know, until the age of 6, I was an only daughter. And so this is a lot of condensed maternal energy kind of all coming down in concentrated form, one at a time, through the generations, which was not the experience of most Mennonite girls. And psychologically, I think that had a lot to do with it. So, okay, here's this little girl, my mother now, who wants a sister, but never gets one, but has the devoted attention of her mother and her namesake, her grandmother. She had 2 Barbara grandmothers. So here she is, the only girl, and both grandmothers have a Barbara to dote on. So that meant you have a picture of how she grew up. They also had much more contact with the world than most Mennonite farmers, in because they went to the central market. They took their goods that they had worked very hard that week to produce to market, directly dealing with customers, and right across the street from Hager's department store. So my mother, at about the age of 10, trotted over to Hager's, was allowed to go through the toy land by herself, and picked out a Shirley Temple doll that she wanted. Now, she didn't go to the movies, and she didn't have all the other pop culture associations with Shirley Temple, but she knew who she was, and she went also to public school. And she really wanted the Shirley Temple doll. She dragged my grandmother into Hager's store, and they are looking at the Shirley Temple dolls when some customer comes along and says, "Hi, and how's market. Your little girl?" Market customer comes along, and "What do you want for Christmas, little Barbara Ann?" And Barbara Ann pipes up and says, "Oh, I want a Shirley Temple doll." And the woman says to my grandmother, "Do you get your daughter everything she wants?" And my grandmother never bought my mother a Shirley Temple doll. Can you see where this story is going? When she is presented at the age of 21 with this little rosy baby, she chooses Shirley for the name. And I forget if I put this in the book or not, but she is still at home with me, because in those days you didn't go to church right away. It took, you know, maybe a week or two before you showed up in church. And during the Sunday that she was at home with me, there was a preacher at church who made a litany of things you should not do. And in that list was, you should not name your children after a movie star. My mother heard about that sermon from my grandmother, the other grandmother on the other side of the family, who reported it. So she felt chagrined, but it was too late. I was already in Shirley.
Have you ever experienced any hostility from readers that reacted to your description of Mennonite growing up?
No, I expected I would, but I can't say that I have.
Some people who said it was not their experience.
Yeah, people who, but nobody who has challenged me
on either authenticity or anything like that?
No. No, I have not, but yet.
But it's your story.
Yeah, that's right.
I empathize so much with your father, his relationship with his father, and all of us have had trouble, you know, pleasing our parents.
Yeah.
I wonder how that impacted you in your childhood now.
Yeah.
Your husband.
My husband happens to be here. Speak to that. It has definitely impacted me in many ways. They're in that list where I talk about the twinkle in their eyes, or no, the list of opposites that my parents represent. I think I conclude that chapter by saying that one of my friends said that much anger directed against a parent would have to show up in overachievement in at least two more generations. And I thought that was really interesting, and probably is somewhat true. Some of that aspiration to compete and win in life and in lots of different arenas comes perhaps from some of that anger. Because my father just wanted to hear from his father, "I love you. And I approve of you, and you are working hard, and I see you're working hard, and your rows are straight," and whatever he could have said in that way would have meant the world to my father. He could never hear that. And he, in turn, tried very hard and succeeded in many ways to be a better father to us in that regard than his father was to him. But his own anger still came out. Here's one image that I didn't write about but is in my mind about my father. And it relates not only to men and patriarchy and to power that men have in traditional religion and in traditional roles like farming, but to this particular father who had his own issues with his father. We sat at a table of the five children, and my father sat here, and I think my mother either sat here or here. And here were the utensils in the cabinets in the kitchen. And a thing I'll never forget is that I was sitting here, and we were about to eat, and my father said to me, "Shirley, get me a spoon." Now, he could have reached around and pulled a spoon out of the drawer, but he wanted me to get up out of my seat, get the spoon, and hand it to him. And I was boiling mad, but I could not say a word. And I'm sure that there were other times when that kind of thing happened. I share some of it. I love my father. I know he loved me. I happen to be, even though I was a girl, I was the firstborn. If you know anything about family systems, he was the firstborn. And so he did identify with me. I think that convertible had to come out of some way of making up for what he did not get from his father. And so, yes, there was some of the ambition, some of the anger, anger, I can get mad at patriarchy and remember the spoon in the drawer, you know, and it represents men who have said to women, you should be quiet, you should be silent, you should be small, and that's there. But fortunately, I have lots of other more positive expressions, and at the time of the death of my father, which is a story that I told this morning in Portland Mennonite Church, I had some of the deepest, most spiritual experiences of my life. And so whatever anger I have carried over the years is mostly washed away by that experience. Yes.
I was going to commend you for writing about this so that many other young women who are subject to this kind of conservatism and obedience to the men in their lives, that they might read this book and find freedom.
I hope so. I hope so. It would be my great desire, and I think it's God's desire as well.
I was not raised with that kind of philosophy, and so I don't have the hang-ups, but I see the others.
Yeah. It is, according to my watch, 8:15, and I think I stand between you and some kind of refreshment.
So let's give Shirley a and Shirley's going to sign books and cards here. So thank you very much for coming. Jerry Barkman is the president of the Pacific Northwest Mennonite Historical Society in a collision.
Thank you very much, Shirley. Let's bow our heads. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you tonight for Shirley and her courage to write of her life in the church. We ask you to touch each one of us in a special way as we go from here. Bless the refreshments we have in the fellowship. We ask in your eternal name. Amen.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
That was very good.
Remember Ray from way back?
We need those tables, two tables moved out to the